Welcome back. This is Daily Buddhism Audio Show number 49. My name is Brian Shell, and I'm your host for the show. You can find the text as well as all links mentioned in this program and all past episodes on the website at www.dailybuddhism.com. We've had some really great questions on this week's show. Of all the stuff we do on the Daily Buddhism, I like answering your questions the most. So send in yours by email or voicemail to brian@dailybuddhism.com or phone them in 24 hours a day to our voicemail line, 937-660-4949. That way we can play your message on the show. No question is too small or too off the wall. If you don't know the answer, it's worth asking. Okay, and this is where I usually do the announcements, but let's keep it short and simple this week and not do any announcements. If you're subscribed to the Daily Buddhism Daily Email Letter, you're probably pretty much up to date already. And if you aren't, why aren't you on the email list? It's free and simple. One email, once a day. DailyBuddhism.com, sign up in the upper right-hand corner. Get your free Daily Buddhism email newsletter. And something new this week, this show is partially sponsored by Mighty Leaf Tea. So if you like to drink tea, whether it's just for enjoyment or in some sort of Buddhist ritual where you use tea, give them a try. www.dailybuddhism.com/tea, T-E-A, and it'll take you right there. But for now, let's get on with this week's show. We started off Monday with a question, as we often do, and a reader wrote in, "I was interested in learning the relationship between Hinduism and Buddhism. Buddha was originally a Hindu, so it's only natural for some of that to have bled into his teachings. Some Buddhist teachings actually talk about Hindu gods. There are also the primary concepts of karma and samsara in Buddhism, which are directly taken from Hinduism. The problem is that having Hinduism bleed into Buddhism makes Buddhism much less a philosophy and more of a religion. I can believe in the philosophy of Buddhism, but not necessarily the religion. So, my question is Buddhism rooted in Hinduism the same way that Christianity is rooted in Judaism? Where to be a Christian you need to basically accept all or most of Judaism too? Or is there no real relationship other than some of the same shared concepts?" Okay, and I answer. As you say, most everyone in that region during Buddha's day was a Hindu. And yes, most of the religious trappings of Buddhism can be traced back to this in some way. Don't think, however, that it was Buddha's plan to invent a whole new religion. In his mind, he was a good Hindu, much in the same way as Jesus considered himself a good Jew. The expansion of things into a full-blown religion took many years after his death. Historically, the growth of Buddhism and Christianity are very similar, just one of many parallels between the two. However, Buddhism is much more flexible and open-ended in what beliefs are required, which is one reason the various sects of Buddhism are so very much different from each other. Hinduism had existed in that part of the world for pretty much forever. Hinduism is the oldest of the major religions, going way back before recorded history. There's no way anyone or any idea in that part of the world could avoid being influenced by this. And those beliefs are still very much a part of Eastern Buddhism today. The Buddhist creation stories and a great majority of the original gods and deities are straight from Hinduism, although there were also many regional additions from China, Japan, and elsewhere. Even the core ideas concerning the cycle of samsara and karma come from Hinduism, although it's a little bit different there. Reincarnation and rebirth is also from Hinduism, but again, has changed a bit over the years. These things are not necessarily so much a part of religion in the East, as they are just sort of the way things work. It's an ingrained part of the culture. However, the further Buddhism spreads away from Asia, the less relevant that Hindu influence gets. And in America, the Hindu influence probably works against Buddhism as much as anything else. Buddhism adapts to culture, not the other way around. Once again, I'll say it. Let's look back to the basics, the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. There's nothing inherently religious in those, and no one is going to argue against their centrality to Buddhism. Everything else is built on top of those. All the rest is at least somewhat optional. Now, certain denominations require certain additional things, and some are very religious in nature. But as we discussed a few weeks ago, you are a Buddhist if you follow the path. That's the only requirement. In my own opinion, if you want to strip all of religion out and use Buddhism as a practice or a philosophy, that's fine. Some people enjoy the rituals and religious aspects, and it helps them stay mindful and respectful, and that's perfectly fine. But it's not a take-it-or-leave-it proposition in the same way that many of the Western religions are. It is all very flexible. And then Tuesday was book review day. Have not done a book review in a long time, so thought this would be a good day to do one. This time the book I read was The Way of Korean Zen by Kusan Sunim. It's published by Weatherhill and Shambhala, 2009, 182 pages. And yes, there is a link to buy the book on Amazon in the show notes. The author, Kusan Sunim, who lived from 1901 until 1983, was the resident master of the Songgwan Sa, one of the largest monasteries in South Korea. He was the first Zen teacher to accept and train Western students in a Korean monastery. The extensive introductory section of the book was written by Stephen Batchelor, author of the book Buddhism Without Beliefs, another one I strongly recommend. There are two major sections to the book, the introduction by Batchelor and the bulk of the book by Master Kusan. The introductory portion explains the history of how Zen spread to Korea, life in a Korean monastery, the biography of Master Kusan, and various remarks about the rest of the book. It's a very long introduction, and it takes probably 25% of the book itself. The balance of the book are translations of Master Kusan's teachings, and are in four parts. Instructions for Meditation, Discourses from a Winter Retreat, Advice and Encouragement, and the 10 Ox Herding Pictures. There's also a very brief glossary at the end. Master Kusan teaches the Huadu method of meditation. Huadu meditation is somewhat similar to meditating on a koan, but there is a difference. A koan is generally a complete situation or story, while the Huadu is just a central question involved. For example, a koan involves specific characters and situations. It's a whole story, while the Huadu is just the question, what is this? Or something along those lines. If you remember back a few weeks ago, what is the sound of one hand would be a Huadu, but the whole long story with the various characters, the students, and the teachers would be the koan. He explains that the Huadu method means keeping that question at the forefront of your mind nonstop while living your life. Everything you do, everything you experience, involves that question and must apply to that question. Seems to me that this is a super challenging form of mindfulness and concentration. But that's what he teaches. This section, called From a Winter Retreat, is a collection of his teachings and lectures given during one 4-month-long retreat that took place one winter. There are various topics and subjects, but again, many of them center on Huadu meditation. This is the largest section of the book and includes lots of different topics, much advice, and much wisdom. And the final portion of the book is Cusan's explanation of the famous 10 ox herding pictures. We've covered those pictures here before, and I don't think Cusan really adds much new to the interpretation. The pictures are very well known, have been explained by many people, and it kind of feels like filler in this case. But overall, it's a good book. The historical introduction and the focus on Huadu are very interesting. It's always hard to really explain koan meditation in a coherent way, but Cusan covers it well and very thoroughly. There are some superficial differences between Korean Zen and Japanese Zen, but nothing really stood out to me as particularly significant. If you're interested in Zen, give this book a try. And speaking of koans, we had our koan for the week. This one is called A Calling Card. Keichu, the great Zen teacher of the Meiji era, was the head of Tofuku, a cathedral in Kyoto. One day, the governor of Kyoto called upon him for the first time. His attendant presented the card of the governor, which read, Kitagaki, Governor of Kyoto. I have no business with such a fellow, said Keichu to his attendant. Tell him to get out of here. The attendant carried the card back with apologies. That was my error, said the governor. And with a pencil, he scratched out the words, Governor of Kyoto. Ask your teacher again. Oh, is that Kitagaki? Exclaimed the teacher when he saw the card. I want to see that fellow. And both of the next two articles generated a lot of comments on the website. If you ever hear a story or article mentioned here that you would like to comment on, discuss, or add your thoughts to, it's very easy. Just go to dailybuddhism.com, find the post that's in question, and at the very bottom, there's a link that says Comments. Click on that, type in your comment, and others can read and see your thoughts and comment back if they choose. But both of the posts for the next 2 days generated quite a few comments, and if you'd like to hear more than just my opinion, then go to the website and read those comments. Many times, the readers will have much more insightful thoughts than I have. So here we go. First question. I have a question and I'm hoping you may have some comments. What happens to Earth when all beings reach nirvana? If all beings progress to enlightenment, then they won't be coming back, right? If so, then the Earth dies. Everything from us to Krill would be gone, at least physically. I don't see that this would be a good thing, since to me the world is a magnificent phenomenon, irrespective of our human experience of living on it. I love this earth and feel lucky to have experienced its natural beauty. I wonder about this. Would it be possible to be enlightened and live on earth too? It's a real sticking point for me. Any comments would be greatly appreciated. Okay, and my comments to this were, if you take it that nirvana means that you exit the cycle of samsara, or rebirth, then that happens after death. A bodhisattva is an enlightened person who is willing to skip that and stick around on earth to help others reach enlightenment. We've covered both of these terms in the past, samsara and bodhisattvas. Theoretically, eventually, someday every being will reach enlightenment, and it would indeed be time for all creatures to move on. To us, here, now, the earth is a beautiful thing that must be protected for future generations. I can't argue with that. However, attachments are something that we will give up after attaining enlightenment, and that includes being attached to the earth. No matter how beautiful it may be, an enlightened person would be willing to let it go if that meant that all suffering would be ended. You also asked, would it be possible to live on earth and be enlightened too? Well, technically, yes, if you return as a bodhisattva, then you can stay behind. At least until that far-off future when everyone has reached nirvana. However, it could also be that such a strong attachment to the Earth might keep you from getting that far in the first place. Attachments, an irrational grasping or desire, are what causes suffering. Attachments, even to things that are otherwise good or wonderful, are still attachments and will cause suffering eventually. And then it was Friday again, and time for the final question of the week. A reader wrote in, "The first thing I would like to say is that I am not what you would call a practicing Buddhist. It just so happens that Buddhism and my natural beliefs and attitudes are expressed in Buddhism. It has actually been through your website and podcast that I have come to realize how Buddhism can help me to an easier and more rewarding journey on a path than the way I've been struggling along on my own. So thank you for that. I mention this because as an amateur, I do not have the vocabulary to talk about the more advanced concepts in Buddhism, and I hope my question makes sense. My question concerns compassion. When I find myself meditating on compassion for all living beings, there often comes a point where I become overwhelmed by what I would say is my love for everything and everyone, to the point that my compassion becomes pity. As soon as pity creeps in, I feel tainted and self-indulgent, and I am not able to get myself back on track. I was hoping that you had some advice about this, or maybe some specific meditations that you or anyone else thinks will help keep me in line." And my response was to start out with a quote from the Dalai Lama. "If you want others to be happy, practice compassion. If you want to be happy, practice compassion." Dalai Lama likes compassion. Okay, well, the first thing that sprung to mind when I read your question was, what's wrong with pity? Isn't it just a strong form of compassion? And then it hit me. No, it's not the same at all. Compassion is genuinely caring about others, understanding their plight, and taking action in your decision to actively help them in some way. Pity is an outpouring of empathy, so strong that you may be tempted to help more out of the need to ease your own sense of guilt or obligation than real compassion. Have you ever seen the TV commercials for charities with the sad-looking, thin and sickly cats and dogs? The ones that have lingering shots of their sad faces and the mournful music playing in the background? And how about the ones with the starving children in Africa, with the emaciated bodies and the flies everywhere? You know what I mean. These commercials aren't appealing to your sense of compassion. They're striving to create pity. Give them money, and you'll feel better for having done something. The central character in pity is you. You feel bad because of whatever the problem may be, and by helping, you make yourself feel better. In the big picture, some good is still being done by donating to these charities. I'm not complaining about the charities, but your personal karma works out differently because of the motives behind the giving. Now let's get on to your question specifically. You're doing what is called metta meditation, sometimes called loving kindness meditation, which we have discussed quite a bit in the past. And you're putting yourself in someone else's extreme situation and losing yourself in pity for them. This is yet again another form of attachment. As a Buddhist grows his or her sense of non-attachment, they can look at things more objectively and feel compassion without too much painful emotion. Compassion is your genuine desire to help others, while pity is all about helping yourself. It's an external thing versus an internal thing. Now, don't misunderstand me. Pity is far from the worst emotion you can experience, but true compassion is much better for everyone involved. You should work towards channeling one emotion into the other. I'm not sure that I have any special meditation tricks to solve this problem. You need to have a clear understanding of the difference between pity and compassion, and I hope I've been able to help with that. Keep that difference in mind as you meditate, and as you feel yourself sliding into pity, use the knowledge to pull yourself back. And that wraps up the 49th podcast of the Daily Buddhism. Keep in mind that the Daily Buddhism runs mostly from your donations, and it's always easy to help out. Just go to www.dailybuddhism.com/donate and click on any of the options there. There are options from anywhere from $1 a month up to $10 a month, or you can fill in the blank and send in anything you'd like right now. While you're looking at the site, keep in mind that the Daily Buddhism Daily Email Newsletter is completely free. All you need to do is go to the site and sign up. No spam, just one email each day. If you have a question on any Buddhism-related topic, send in your questions by email to brian@dailybuddhism.com or phone them in at 937-660-4949. Or post your comments, thoughts, or ideas in the comments section of any individual blog post on the website. Thank you, and I'll see you next week.